Letitia was born in the year 982 of the Common Era. That is to say, he was born about 1500 years after the Buddha. It's quite important for us to realize this fact. He came at the end of a very long period of development of the Dharma in India. We could say that he, Letitia, was as far removed from the Buddha in point of time as Martin Luther was from Jesus. This will give us some idea of the historical perspective involved. Incidentally, it is rather unfortunate that we have to refer to events, dates in Buddhist history as occurring either CE or BCE. Yeah? It used to be, of course, BC or AD, but there's been some change, some improvement more recently, and we now say CE, Common Era, or BCE, Before Common Era. But even this is rather unfortunate, because when we have these dates in Buddhist history, CE and BC, it suggests a sort of break in the continuity of Buddhist history, which is not really there at all. We are now living in the 2545th, I think it is, year of the Buddhist era, at least according to the Southern Reckoning. So we should try not to allow that break, which is suggested by CE and BCE, to influence us when we survey the course of Buddhist history in the East. But to get back to Letitia. Letitia was born in Bengal, in eastern India. We're not sure exactly where he was born, but it may have been in a village, as it now is, near Dhaka, the capital of the present-day state of Bangladesh. And we're told, all the accounts agree, that he was born of noble parents. In fact, his father may even have been the local chief, the local Raja. Later accounts, of course, tend to represent Letitia as having been the son of a great king. And there, of course, his biographers take as their model the legendary life of the Buddha, because if you can represent Letitia or any other great Buddhist as having been the son of a king and the heir to the throne, well, when he gives up all that, it's even more impressive. But actually, it seems his father was really not much more than the local chief. No doubt an important man, but within a relatively small area. Letitia apparently received a good education. He studied various arts and sciences, and according to some accounts at least, he was married at an early age to 5 wives. That suggests he probably did come from the nobility, and had 7 sons and 2 daughters. So presumably he wasn't lacking in worldly experience. But what about his religious life at this time? Strangely enough, considering his later career, his religious life at this time was almost entirely tantric. In a way, this is not surprising. Letitia lived towards the end of the Buddhist period in India, and within 300 years of his death, Buddhism had practically disappeared from the land of its birth, the last blow having been given by the destruction of the great monastic universities by the Turkish Muslim invaders. And even in Letitia's own day, Buddhism was more or less confined to northeast India. As most of you are probably aware, after the Buddha's parinirvana, Indian Buddhism passed through three great phases of development, each phase lasting about 500, maybe 600 years. There was a Hinayana phase, a phase during which the Hinayana was dominant, a Mahayana phase, and finally a Vajrayana or Tantric phase. I've spoken and written elsewhere about these three great phases, for instance in the introduction to the survey, so there's no need for me to go into them now. Most of you, I'm sure, are quite familiar with them. Suffice it to say that by the time Atisha was born, the Vajrayana, or Tantric Buddhism, was predominant in that part of India where Buddhism still survived. Atisha, therefore, grew up in a Tantric environment, in a Tantric atmosphere, even, so to speak. And it is said that he received his first Tantric initiation from his own father. And after that, we're told, he associated with many great and famous Tantric yogins and teachers of the Vajrayana. And according to some accounts, among his own teachers were some of those who are included in the list of the 84 Mahasiddhas, or great perfect ones. So we find Atisha during these early years, when he was still apparently living at home with his family, practicing Tantric meditation, taking part in the Ganachakras or Tantric feasts, and listening to what are called the secret Tantric songs, which imparted esoteric instruction through that particular medium. According to at least one account, he even went to the land of Udayana and practiced the Tantras in the company of the Dakinis, whatever that might mean. So in this way, he spent very many years. He gained a thorough knowledge of the Vajrayana, of its rituals, of its meditations, and so on. But it seems that despite his thorough immersion in the Vajrayana, despite his vast acquaintance with Tantric disciplines and teachings, it seems he was not satisfied. He felt he had not made any real spiritual progress. He had certainly not gained enlightenment. Now this is strange. This is strange. In theory, the Vajrayana is not just the latest phase in the development of Indian Buddhism. In theory, at least, it's also the highest stage of the Buddhist spiritual path and life, at least according to the Triyana system. But here was Atisha. He'd practiced the Vajrayana systematically, thoroughly, sincerely for 15 or more years. And he'd had some of the greatest Tantric yogins as his teachers. But he was still not satisfied with his spiritual progress, still not satisfied with his spiritual attainments. He felt that there still was something missing, something he hadn't achieved, something he hadn't experienced. Perhaps, in a sense, everything was lacking, everything was missing. So what had gone wrong? Well, in a word, or a few words, with which I think most of you will be very familiar, Atisha had been following the path of irregular steps. Before he could go forward, he had to go back. He had to start following the path of regular steps. And this is the sort of thing that happens to us. Not once, but perhaps many times. We find perhaps that we've got stuck in our spiritual life. We feel dissatisfied with our spiritual progress. We may feel, well, here we are, been practicing all these years, doing all the right things, very good, very obedient, all the rest of it. But we haven't really made any progress. Maybe we've been at it. Maybe we've been good Buddhists of one sort or another for 10, 12, 15, even 20 years. But perhaps the time comes when we feel that, well, we're not making any progress. Or perhaps we feel we've never made any progress at all. Well, as and when we reach that point, it's no use blaming conditions. It's no use saying, well, I've got a full-time job, so what can you expect? Or, I've got a wife, what a husband, and children. So what else can you expect of me, just a poor, miserable householder Buddhist, So, or you might say, well, what's the use of blaming me? I mean, perhaps I'm a busy monk, I have to go on giving lectures all the time and teaching people and attending international conferences all over the place, A jet-set Buddhist monk, So, well, there are lots of them around these days. Some of them are good friends of mine. I don't see them very often, because they fly in and they fly out. Their visits, well, I could say, like angels, few and far between. But they're not exactly like angels, but they certainly do, come and go with astonishing rapidity. So, if a person in that sort of condition is not making any real spiritual progress, it's no use blaming external conditions. It's no use our blaming our lifestyle. And of course, it's no use blaming our teachers. Oh, if only my teacher had given me more time, if only I could see him every day, sit at his feet every day, look up into his eyes, well, I'm sure then I'd make, more progress. And sometimes you start thinking, well, perhaps, your teacher doesn't really care for you very much. So you perhaps start thinking, well, perhaps you'd better start looking for another teacher. Well, that's the sort of thing that happens. At one level, of course, we call it shopping around, the Sainsbury syndrome, or even the Tesco syndrome for the better educated. And, of course, we may blame our fellow disciples. We might say, well, here am I working hard, maybe for the centre, maybe for the order, or maybe just for the Dharma in general. But I don't get much help. I don't get much cooperation. They just leave it to me. I'm all by myself, and they don't give me emotional support when I need it. There's no one's shoulder that I can go and have a good weep on, and no one with whom I can be vulnerable, and all that sort of thing. So, in that way, we sometimes blame our feral disciples. So, when we get into that sort of state, I was going to say stage, but it isn't really a stage, it's much more just a state.